Views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
From victim to victor, in Law & Disorder Radio, Megan Lyons will show you how to find true healing and inner peace through the art and practice of self-love. In this hit show, Megan will work to uncover the deeper psychological proclivity that fuels toxic behavioral patterns, and she will help you integrate creative processes and holistic healing so you can effectively process and transmute trauma. Law and Disorder Radio, where spirituality meets the law, starts now.
Hi, this is Megan Lyons, and this is the first edition or first episode of Law and Disorder Radio. For the first episode, I have as a very special guest, Kristen Sinantra Walker, who is a very good friend of mine and also CEO of Mental Health News Radio Network, and I'm going to let her talk about herself in a second and all of her fabulous accolades. Kristen, where are you today?
I am. Hey, Megan, I'm so glad you're doing this, first off.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited for this. Law and Disorder, so awesome. I'm actually calling in from New York City, New York. So if you guys hear sirens and ambulances and all cabs honking, you're in the thick of it in the city with me.
Cool. Well, it'll be authentic for sure. Yeah, the focus of my show will hopefully be to talk about some of the issues, you know, that are plaguing humanity today, such as narcissism and various disorders, character disorders, mental health. Orders as any interplay with the law, as far as that goes. So in my practice, I do family law and I do other civil matters as well, but I see it obviously the most in my family law cases where my clients are facing an adversarial partner that is character disordered. And, you know, that can be a severe case, or it can be, you know, just more run-of-the-mill. I mean, I'm seeing the dynamic in almost all cases where there's, you know, these character disorders displayed of narcissism and antisocial personality disorders. And then how that sort of affects the overall case as far as in and out of the courtroom, dynamics with other attorneys, judges, just sort of as a broad landscape. But, you know, this topic can really be very broad and very vast, and it's affecting certainly every layer of society as we see it, without a lot of people maybe knowing what these disorders are and how they affect our perception of reality and just sort of how they affect day-to-day decisions that we make, or maybe we're not even consciously aware of these decisions or these dynamics, and thus they can be powerful because we're not, you know, enlightened about them or knowledgeable about how to navigate through different situations in which we're dealing with somebody that's character disordered. Mm-hmm. So Kristen, tell me about your show and just sort of your background with mental health and behavioral issues. Give me a little bit of background on what your, you know,
what
your
I'm all
main
about?
Gigs are. Yep.
Well, I have a technology consulting. I try. I have a technology consulting company that focuses on the behavioral health field. And interestingly enough, as soon as I got into this field, I've always been invested in mental health. It's something, mental illness is something that runs rampant in my family. And so, and I've definitely dealt with depression, anxiety, PTSD, for anyone that doesn't know, that's complex PTSD. I've had my own struggles and been in therapy, and the behavioral health profession has done so much for me personally and a lot of volunteer work. I mean, since I was probably about 9 years old, I've been volunteering in various areas of behavioral health, but it wasn't until I started working in the field of behavioral health that I realized that I had been dealing with someone who is a psychopath and had that completely shred my existence for quite some time and lower my capability to deal with other psychopaths. In the past, I'd run across these kind of people. I grew up with them, definitely knew them, but none of them had really scorched my soul other than my biological father. But none of them had really gotten in and under my skin until a few years ago when I entered the life of one in the field of behavioral health. So I think that's an interesting way to meet one. But I've learned a lot since then. And meeting him, you know, spawned me having a podcast and talking about mental health issues, all mental health issues. But every show that we do on Mental Health News Radio about narcissism, psychopathy, sociopaths, all of those things, antisocial personality disorder, those are our highest rated shows. And that just goes to show you, you know, what an epidemic this is out in the world.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a really hot topic on the internet, and it's starting to be a lot more commonplace as discussed, I think, on television shows, movies. I mean, I think it always was, but without maybe the label or the discussion of, you know, it being narcissism or psychopathy. I think it's always been sort of maybe more covert or more subtle. But now it's certainly really popular. And I think more and more people are wanting to be educated on it. And they want to know, you know, how to deal with these people or how to deal with the aftermath of the emotional trauma of dealing with a psychopath, which leads us into kind of the discussion of today's podcast, which is a fear and arrested development inside emotional development. And so I thought that was a really interesting topic that, you know, you kind of came up with, Kristen, as we talk about these things often. And you have some fabulous experts and maybe some non-experts that have some tremendous insight into this phenomenon of emotional development, psychological development, on your show. And so I guess we can, you know, talk about maybe some of the insight that you've gleaned through that. And then just, we can also talk about it otherwise, that how we've personally experienced some things or what, you know, our latest maybe thoughts or theories are, because they tend to change as the days go on. But
as we become more enlightened.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So we're constantly shifting our perspective.
Yeah. It's the gift that keeps on giving, unfortunately. I mean, it does, when you're not someone who is character disordered, there are people that can behave deplorably at different points in their lives. And that does not mean that they have a character disorder. It means that, you know, life has smacked them hard or something from their childhood came up and, you know, reared its ugly head and they're working through that behavior. When we're talking about a character disorder, we're talking about, you know, someone who that is what they are plagued with and what they plague others with throughout the course of their lifetime. They are not going to change. They're not healable from that disorder. This is what I hear from the neuroscientists, psychiatrists, psychologists that, you know, have come on my show. These people just, you know, they're how they are treated is through behavior modification therapy, but they aren't treated and cured is what I have heard. So, you know, I want to make sure that we have that distinction there, but what they end up doing with us, those of us who are not character disordered, is ravage our lives, ravage our self-esteem, cause mental health issues, suicidal thoughts, from, you know, our experience with them. So as Sandra Brown, which I know you've read, you know, her book, Megan, she's a wonderful teacher. And I thought she put it wonderfully when she came on my show and said, you know, forever. And she said this other places as well, but, her job as a therapist was to work with those who have character disorders. And she realized that she was going to spend the rest of her life working with the same 80 people on behavior modification, or she could switch and help the victim. And you know, nothing was going to happen. No growth was going to happen. It was just a matter of maintaining their or managing their behavior so they don't inflict or inflict as little damage as possible on the people around them. Or she said, you know, or I can go work with the 80,000 people that these 80 have caused damage to and watch those people grow and transform their lives and, you know, become all that they were meant to be because, you know, they are warriors. So they either put your lights out or you grow. And thankfully for you and I, you know, we took the path of growth, you know?
Yeah, because I think that with trauma, it's, and I think that this maybe is, you know, there's a lot of, I think, research out there or maybe definitive conclusions that state that a lot of these character disorders, you know, the biological component associated with them is from this, you know, sort of primal trauma that occurs really, really early on in, you know, maybe from 0 to 3, so it might even be before there's conscious awareness of the trauma. But what happens is either, you know, that trauma is transmuted and then we see the growth or, and a lot of times, you know, the individuals that transcend this sort of traumatic explosion that occurs early on is, you know, the people that typically take on a lot of outside energy, you know, whether we call them empathic or just highly sensitive people. There's a lot of different terms for it, but it seems that the that was their sort of the way that the body responded to it. And then the character disordered individuals, they in almost all cases, and I think Ross Rosenberg talks about this a lot in his book, the different ways of that the trauma is responded to in his book, which I'm totally at a loss for the name of it right now.
What's human,
the name of
his human book? Magnet so, syndrome.
Yes, human magnet syndrome. That's really, really great. And it goes into all these attachment theories of trauma and explains how this original attachment trauma at a young, at, you know, very young, 0 to 3 typically, is responded to. So then with the character disordered individuals, typically they have gone into more of like a fight or flight or a disassociative mode in which that's how the trauma was perhaps responded to or processed or not processed in their case, because their body went into sort of survival mode in which, you know, maybe they never, it split and they didn't even
persona.
Integrate the experience.
Yeah.
Right. So
and
that's,
you know,
the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde.
Exactly, exactly. And believe me, you do not want to see them with the mask off. We definitely should get into that. But what's interesting, too, is that some of them didn't have trauma. The psychopath that I got involved with did not have early childhood trauma. He has a sibling who is a highly empathic person, and he used to talk about his sibling as if, you know, he was analyzing something under glass. He didn't understand why his sibling was so caring and so could intuitively sense things. That to him, that was like magic, because he did not have possessed that ability. They were not abused as children. They weren't. He was just born this way, born with gray matter missing. And, you know, Dr. Jim Fallon, who, you know, wrote an excellent book about his own findings of him being a pro-social psychopath, you know, and he's also a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist. I interviewed him and, you know, he did not have a horrible childhood either. So they aren't always created. Some of them are actually born.
Right. Right. And then I think sometimes there's even the sort of template where the, you know, the child had maybe like some emotional incest going on, or there's just that overbearing enmeshment between, you know, them and the mom or what have you. Typically, I think that's what I've seen. And it's not a situation where they had any neglect, but maybe they didn't have an opportunity to breathe. So they were never maybe apart from their caregiver. They had so much attention and so much response to maybe if they cried at all, even just a tiny little bit, their mom would, you know, not want them to.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Right. Maybe their mom didn't want them to experience any pain or discomfort for any moment. So then that child isn't going to develop the coping responses or mechanisms. And then they learn that they just get everything. You know, all they have to do is cry and, you know, they sort of get their way. So that's probably how the emotional manipulators are templated, you know, from the get-go. And, you know, they learn how to do these little things. Like even we see with our dogs. I mean, I see with my dog, he knows like what look to give me to get what he wants. And I mean, he's only a dog, so.
That's why, you know, when I thought about this title, I thought, you know, fear and arrested development, you know, what does that mean? You know, fear as a child, you're afraid of a lot of things. You're this innocent, helpless baby, and you are supposed to be protected by, you know, the adults around you. And if you are overprotected, you never develop resiliency.
Right.
You don't get to experience, oh, I lived through that. Oh, okay, I will live through this next. Because we're all going to get punched, you know, by life. It happens. And we're going to get punched many times as part of the human experience. But, you know, each time you do that, are you someone that has the resiliency to get through it? You know, take your blows, grow, evolve, transform. And if you had a parent that was always coddling and, you know, coming to you, taking care of your every need. I mean, there are parents out there that still do that to their, you know, adult children. And these people, you know, that's emotional, you know, arrested development there. This person is a grown up and they can't, you know, do anything without checking in with their mother or, you know, whoever it is. So it wreaks havoc in different ways throughout someone's life. And you can see it play out in their lack of interpersonal relationships with people. If it's someone who is a highly sensitive person, and you can see it in their abuse within interpersonal relationships with other people who exploit to get, you know, there's nothing like seeing, I mean, picture a baby crying, wah, 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 wah. Okay, mommy comes, picks it up, gives, you know, swaddles it, takes care of it, takes it to her breast, whatever. That's not attractive when you're 40 years old. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that kid's kind of old, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I had a 300-pound football player that, let me tell you, when that man cried in front of me and had a gun in his hand, you're looking at a sociopath. And that is not, that's not only unattractive, that's frightening, you know?
It's kind of like, have you ever heard, you know, the Peter Pan syndrome, but then I guess there's something similar called the King Baby syndrome. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I've heard of that one. I'll have to Google that one. King Baby syndrome.
That's cute. And it's very telling as to what that is, but you know, it's just that coddling and that constant praise and, you know, that somebody just becomes accustomed to. And going back, I wanted to go back to the whole fear concept that we were talking about.
Yeah.
It's like, whose fear is that? You know, is it the fear of the parents that if they don't respond to the child's cries, that, you know, that something will be wrong with the child, or is it, you know, that's kind of an important thing too, I think, is whose fear is that? And then it becomes a projected fear.
Absolutely. Oh, that's brilliant, Megan. I mean, yes, I would say that that's projected fear. It's from the parent's own inability to grow. So, you know, a narcissist is going to be nurtured by a parent who is a narcissist. So, you know, the parent is one themselves. They are an emotional baby at whatever age they're having children. And so all of their fears, worries, concerns, you know, are just poured onto their child or projected onto their child. And they really, what's discussed, you know, amongst the academics about this is that, you know, these people are constantly living in a world of delusion. They're like they're an addict for emotional. Their alcohol is empathy. Their alcohol is the emotions of others. That's what they're addicted to because they have no ability to regulate their own. So they regulate themselves through other people. Now, you and I, as friends, can regulate each other's emotional temperatures because we're friends, but that's reciprocal and we don't take too much from each other. We put in to each other more than, you know, what we take out. And when you're dealing with someone who, you know, as a narcissist, all they do is take. That's it. That's all right. They do is take.
And they may present a nice facade that they are giving, but what I've learned is it's usually something that for them doesn't require a whole lot of effort. Like I used to think that. Hold on.
They're lazy. Yeah, that's the thing. They're emotionally lazy because they've been able to get by taking, you know, so much from other people emotionally that they never developed the ability to hold themselves emotionally in a mature fashion.
Right. And sorry about that. What I was going to say is that I think typically what they do as well that's really, in their mind, brilliant. But and maybe at first we are so just completely enthralled by it and it seems really clever and brilliant too. But then once we deal with more of them or even the same person over and over again, they kind of just do the same sort of tactics. They don't get too creative. But I used to think my ex was so clever with things he would say and birthday cards and things like that. And but really, it really didn't take much effort for him. I mean, I'm sure he just Googled something and took the language from there. And all he knew that all he had to do was create some emotional, right, you know, stimulation on my end or get at my empathy or get at my, you know, pull on those heartstrings and then to create more of an emotional earthquake. You know, he knew that he had to do something that would create abandonment trauma or,
yes,
you know, something that would be morally depraved or something that would really upset me. And then I think that the emotions that feed off of one another too, with fear, is the guilt.
Yes.
You know, the guilt and shame. Obviously, they use those to their advantage because those are some powerful emotional states that will really create a powerful emotional transaction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we've talked about this and, you know, what you've experienced too. I mean, these are people that study. I mean, this is fun for them. This is a chess game and you are on a, you know, your emotions and all of your wounds are studied like a chess, you know, game is. And they're going to, they become masters at unearthing all that scares you. It's, you know, it's like the movie, Stephen King's It, you know, what was the clown able to do? It was able to feed on those people's fear. Well, that is what these people do as well. So fear is an important tool for them to use with you, the person who can be feared, because you are not weak. People equate fear with weakness. No, it is not. The fear is survival. And if you have wounds, they're going to, you know, root those out and find out every minute detail and test you. I mean, perfect example, Megan, I'd love to hear one from you, but I know that I had told the 300-pound baby Huey, as I came to call him, King Baby, there you go, exactly. I had told him, hey, you know, it really wounded me when I was married to my ex-husband because he didn't like to be touched. And so I would go touch him and he would, you know, always pull away. And I found out later that, you know, well, that was because he's in constant physical pain. So it wasn't that he was pulling away from me. It was that he was in pain. Well, you know, I married him when I was 18. I didn't know such things at 18. I just felt wounded and abandoned. And it, you know, it was a core wound of mine because I had been abandoned as a child by my biological father. So I tell this to baby Huey, and his response was to the next time I saw him, and it was fascinating. I mean, it was repulsive, but it was just riveting to watch this man who couldn't keep his hands off me, by the way, from previous visits, where I had to go, okay, you know what? You're married. Like, this is not appropriate. Stop touching me. I'm not a meal. Stop looking at me like I'm a meal for you. I mean, please. To the next time I go to visit him, I'm a touchy person. I mean, I've give you a hug. I'll give whoever. I put my hand on his arm to tell him something, and he looked at me, got excited, got a glint in his eye, and he quick moved his hand away. And I didn't think anything about that. And then he did it again. I like patted him on the knee about something, like a joke. And he quick made a big play of pulling his knee away. And I was like, you jerk. You are totally doing that because I told you that I had an issue with this. And that's fun for these people. How to wound you.
Right. Right. It's just like
fodder for them. Yeah.
It becomes their source of, I guess, enjoyment or their source of entertainment. And it's, you know, and it's because we did have that conversation where we, you know, I guess had a vulnerable moment, or which we probably don't view it as vulnerable for us to just tell somebody else our
something
from the past. But for them, they don't do a lot of that sharing. And if they do share, it's probably scripted or it's probably false. You know, I believe some of them I do think maybe did have a traumatic event and they disassociated from it, or they don't recall it, or maybe they don't have a memory of it. Who knows? That's not going to be for all cases. I think for some that they might. And so they begin to adopt stories, you know, that they were molested, that they were abused. And now that becomes their narrative because they know that it will elicit an emotional response. And like I said, they become really kind of lame. They become not very creative, and you can usually tell when they're lying about it. And
it's like they almost lazy.
They're very lazy, and they're very lazy with their tactics and manipulation after a while too.
That's the thing that kills me. And I know you see this as an attorney, but it's like, they're so lazy. Like I had one that, you know, worked for me for a while and just as a colleague, not an employee, but, you know, as a colleague. And after telling me, blowing so much compliments, you know, in my direction all the time, I started to get a cavity if I heard another one because they were so overblown. But this is how effusive this person is with anything. And then I realized, oh, this is how they get supply, is by blowing as many compliments at people as possible. Then they can, you know, extract money from them, emotional support, whatever. And what when I sat down with this person who was supposed to do this grand thing for my organization, I realized that it took them 3 hours to type 2 paragraphs. And I went, wait a minute, you never learned to type? Like, you're in your 40s. You've never actually learned to type. Well, it's the story around that was, well, I was abused and I'm afraid to use my fingers. And I thought, no, you're just lazy. Like, you're lazy.
Right.
Yep. Didn't learn to type because you're lazy. You use your mouth and your charm to try to get away with as much as you can because you won't sit down and actually type. And that's that arrested development. Like, pick a skill and master it. Something as simple as typing you cannot do because you're lazy, not because you're traumatized, you know?
Right. And they may have a lot of this self-talk going on where maybe they do believe their own lies and justifications and excuses that just feed into the laziness and also the lack of identity. Like, they never seem to have, you know, one thing that they've maybe put a lot of time in or effort in, because maybe they have a core belief that was, you know, that core belief may have been established due to a parent telling them that they weren't good enough, or, you know, that was probably some of it. And then they also adopted whatever their parent believed instead of, because we've all been told by somebody, whether it's our parent or a coach or somebody at church or the government or a friend that was maybe, you know, jealous or something like that, or competitive. I mean, we've all been put down, and it's like we can either choose to adopt that put down or we can rise above it and say, and I think that at that point, it's really a pivotal moment for when we gain in strength and kind of establish our identity. I think that might be, you know, a great experience for us. And for us dealing with these people, these narcissists, if we can sort of discard a lot of the, you know, negative programming that they have attempted to instill in us and mind control us and hypnotize us, if we can sort of unravel that and disempower that entire strategy, well, boy, now we have really gained in strength because we now see the light. You know, and we see that this strategy is used by so many in today's society. Basically, it's what runs the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the what they don't want is to be unmasked, because that, you know, that's death. That's death to them. They also don't want zero attention. So as much as they tick you off, hurt you, you want to get back, you know, at them in some way or another, wound them back, whatever it is, because you're just mortified. The best way to hurt them, not that you as a good person want to do that. You have your moments, your fantasy moments, of course, but you're not the one that goes around hurting people. That's what they do. But, you know, the best way really to wound them is to completely ignore them and to go on and live a successful, happy life that they have zero part of and zero mention. And that's what, you know, the part that I feel like I took a hit with my show, and I'm okay to do that. I'm taking one for the team, was that I continued to talk about my experiences, which is a form of supply for the ones that I know listen that have hurt me, because they're still getting supply out of that because I'm talking about them. But the reward for my doing that was that it's helped so many people who just were like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I went through. So I was willing to quote unquote take the hit, knowing that I'm giving these people supply, because on the other side of that, ignoring them is the worst thing you can do to them, but also unveiling them is the second worst thing you can do. So that's what I spent a lot of time doing is, you know what, we're going to talk about how this emperor is actually naked. They don't like that.
Right. I think definitely exposing the situation, not necessarily in a vindictive manner or not necessarily in a way to, you know, smear them with the intentions of ruining them, but just to talk about what happened in a truthful manner, in an emotionally authentic manner, that is exactly what they hate the most, because it does rob them of the ability to exploit others. Yes. Number one, it sort of educates other people on their tactics, because as we know, their tactics are not all that sophisticated and creative. Once we really dissect them, they're quite sophomoric and juvenile.
Yes.
And so they hate that. And then, and if we're speaking about them in a way that's not putting them on a pedestal and in a way that's not, you know, emotionally enchanting, and we're talking about them as somebody who enabled us to grow spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically, and allowed us to transcend, then I really don't think that they're going to like hearing that. And I don't really think that they would view that as, you know, as supply, because I think that that would just totally infuriate them to know that all of their tactics abuse only served as a means to transcend us. And by speaking our truth and just our truth, our situation, what happened to us and how we learned.
That's good, Megan. I am breathing that in, because you're right. I've carried so much guilt and shame around, you know, exposing these people, feeling like I'm this bad person who's talked about them, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But you're right. I didn't look at it that way. Yeah.
Mm. That's exactly what they want. And I actually had my ex use the Bible against me and the Word of God against me. And there was, which is actually called Christian narcissism or biblical narcissism, which is highly fascinating too. But one thing that he would, it's that whole use of guilt and shame as a means to emotionally manipulate, and one, and by the use of fear specifically, which keeps us down, keeps us in a state of emotional arrested development, keeps us just vibration down overall. And one thing that he would say to me when I would, tell him, you know, I'm going to expose you and I'm going to speak the truth so that other people don't go through this. So other people, because what, you know, some of this stuff was just so heinous and so egregious and criminal, you know, not to mention criminal, that me as an attorney, it's almost incumbent upon me to speak the truth, because if I don't, to me, that carries a greater moral obligation or responsibility or repercussion than me, you know, being quiet. Because what he would say to me is, well, you know, he would even use Jesus and say, well, Jesus would say, you know, turn the other cheek, and if you're going to expose me and everything else, and, you know, if you're going to do that, then you're not really living like a Christian, are you?
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like, it's just like, oh my God. Now, and it's all about the intention again, you know, and I think processing emotional trauma, one of the ways to do it is obviously to speak about it. And if we're speaking about it in ways that will not only help, you know, us, but help other people, that, how many times did you in your process, I mean, I had nobody other than my therapist who was good. I mean, she was almost more of like a life coach. She would help me to sort of, she would help me see things that I didn't see. But really, and that, I guess that is her role, you know, it was my role and my job only to sort of really process everything that happened and go through the gamut of emotions. That can't ever be substituted, but you know, I had really nobody to go through. I watched Ross Rosenberg. He was one of the first people I found on YouTube when he talked about the feelings and the way he described the feelings of pathological loneliness, and you know, that was sort of what would feed into us going back to the narcissist or the abuser or the emotional manipulator. You know, that to me, when I saw his video, I was like, oh my gosh, that's me. That's exactly how I feel. And I really hadn't heard too many other people describe it that way. So thank God for that video. That was really helpful. And I, you know, found other coaches and videos like Lisa Romano talk about codependency and things like that. And, you know, that was really great. But I just really didn't have too many other people to talk to about it. And one thing that I felt like hurt me even more, and I'm sure you could attest to this as well, and I don't know if any guests on the show have talked about this, but just the abuse, and probably inadvertent abuse, but abuse nonetheless, that we would experience now from friends and family that would not, you know, vindicate our experience. They would perhaps diminish or discard the experience and then sort of re-traumatize us in a sense, because they may even say, hey, that experience didn't happen, or that wasn't so bad, or at least you didn't get, you know, murdered or punched in the face by the guy or whatever, but not understanding the implications of emotional abuse. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit and how those can be even worse than physical abuse.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Because they're the wounds are invisible. That's part of the problem. If you have a bruise on your arm, you can say, hey, I have a look, you know, and you, for you, the person that had that happen to you, not that anyone wants to have physical abuse happen, but you can't, it's tangible because you see what happened to you. And with emotional abuse, you can't, and people will tell you that you're crazy. People will look at these people and think that they're, I mean, it used to make me sick. That was the part that was really hard for me. Now it isn't so hard because I know they always, you know, they always fall on their own sword because of their laziness and because they are disordered. But in the beginning, it just drove me to the brink of insanity that, you know, people thought that they were, I mean, I've heard Heart of Gold, because they watched some, you know, Baby Huey do a video about himself, of course. And, oh, he's got a heart of gold. And I'm like, do you have any idea how horrible this person is to their children, to their spouse, that they were to me, that they are to their business partner, to call it, that they just use people and use the waterworks to, you know, and charm to, you know, extract things from them. I mean, do you have any idea? And I wanted to go run around saving everybody from these people. And
right.
It felt like another personal wound that someone out there thinks that they're wonderful. Oh my gosh. And then I, you know, I worked through that because I go to therapy and realize it's not my job to go out there and, you know, save everybody from this person. It is my job, or I've taken it upon myself, to talk about these people and what they do so that other people can go, ah, okay. And maybe witness, not that particular person possibly, but any person that behaves this way, witness right. signs ahead of time, so they don't get in as deep as I have with these people, you know?
I think that becomes part of the maybe addictive cycle and part of the compulsion. If we've been with a lot of pathological narcissists right. that feed off our emotional supply. So if we end the relationship and we've gone no contact, which can be brutal for those have that addiction, you know, to that toxicity, which is almost like a trauma bond, Stockholm syndrome type deal. Once we've sort of cut ourselves off from it, I think that that's, and for me, that was also a way to like substitute that is, you know, to focus on, you know, maybe trying to help other people or whatever, become a savior and a rescuer. Because it's somewhat of a compulsion within personalities of highly sensitive people. Because what I truly believe now, and I don't think you and I have ever even talked about this, but it's definitely something that would fill up a whole show. But I think people like us that are really empathic and highly sensitive, I think that we were sort of groomed, you know, from very young, like I said, you know, 0 to 3 and then so on. We were templated to sort of, ignore our emotions
Absolutely.
For the sake of the emotions of someone else. So
yes.
it's almost like a self-denial. Like we're not worthy to feel this way or that
yes.
way. Not to say that we, the difference is we didn't deny the memory or the existence. I think sociopaths, they have more of an identity disorder where their entire identity has been somewhat stifled or ignored. And so they don't even have a base identity. So that's why they have all these choreographed, you know, masks and A, B, C, D, and E personalities. With us, we don't necessarily have our identity that's stifled, but the emotions associated with the identity, which is what gives us a human. And that's what makes us human beings is our emotions. And the society that we live in now, our emotions are so stifled. And I even hear a lot of like new age doctrines. I don't know if it comes from new age, but I hear stuff sometimes like from speakers that, you know, feelings aren't facts and all this silliness. And it's like, well, no, they're not necessarily facts. But like, if you condition yourself to totally disregard your feelings and emotions or to otherwise like place judgments on them all the time, that have some sort of, you know, weight moving forward, then I think that that's where it becomes really problematic because emotions are just energy in motion and,
right.
you know, we need to just let them pass through and they don't define us. They don't define, there's no finality with them. They're just a response to stimulus in the environment, to trauma, which is an energetic state as well. And it's like, I feel that we always place judgments around these things, but
yeah.
if you kind of just look at it as an experience and allow it to pass through without ignoring it and, you know, or absorbing it, if we just absorb it without releasing it later, that's when we see a lot of problems in the physical body that manifest.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one thing so important for your listeners to hear is we as an empathic person, we will escape our own feelings because that's if we had childhood abuse, that's something that we do as a survival mechanism. Narcissists are all about their feelings. Their feelings are more important than anybody else's. Other people's feelings don't exist. So you can imagine an empath and a narcissist getting together. Here's one that will put themselves last. Well, the narcissist is always going to put themselves first. I mean, I remember having conversations with someone where, you and I are doing this show. Let's give a perfect physical example of realism right here. You and I are doing this show, your show, and you and I are taking breaks to let each other take part in the conversation. In conversations with this narcissist, they would jump in, interrupt, and there's some interruption that goes on with people in natural conversation, and that's fine, but I'm talking chronic interruption and would bring up topics that had zero relevance to what we were just discussing, and what they had to say was more important than anyone else, and their emotions and their upsetness and their anger was more important and took up so much volume, so much emotional space, because they absolutely believe that they are the center of the universe.
Right. Their core beliefs, which is the sounding board from all other beliefs and emotions and everything else, is that of, it is one of egocentrism, and that they are God, and that they it's a belief system that's, in my opinion, really flawed and really backwards, and a lot of people have adopted it. Is that it's this sort of turning away from what really matters and what's really important.
Yeah,
we are all connected.
Exactly. Exactly, that we're all connected and that other people's feelings matter. Well, we empaths run around, like, you'll check in with me every couple of days. How are you doing? What's going on? You're literally concerned about how I'm doing because you, Megan, are a highly, highly, high, probably one of the most empathic people that I have ever known. And you actually care about what's going on with me. A narcissist is going to possibly mimic that behavior and they'll ask you how you're doing, but it doesn't take long before the conversation quickly becomes about them. And someone going through a bad time is going to do that too. But you see over the course of time that that behavior goes away as they get through their hard time, and then they have more room to care about others and so on. But a narcissist is consistently always themselves. It always is going to be about them. No matter what, there's no room for anyone else. They don't grow. That's that arrested development. They do not, they are
right.
Always consistently a narcissist.
Right. And I think it comes from, again, that belief that we were talking about, that belief or belief system that sort of, is predicated on this false belief that comes from a place of fear. So going back to what we were talking about with fear and how this is all interrelated, is their belief will always come from a fear-based place, which is just a lower vibrational belief that, a lot of times people that are in that state, I think in all cases, people that are in a fear-based panic-like state, they're only able to often access, part of their brain, which is, the reptilian brain. It's the fight or flight. And then we have the hormonal responses to that, which create this paralysis or like a frozen response, mm-hmm. in which literally access to consciousness is shut off. So it's almost as if, you just become in survival mode. And people who are constantly in survival mode, they are always operating from a place of fear, and that's projected now into the outwards world, and everybody is viewed as a threat. And I think that's why when you're dealing with one, they engage in little behaviors because they're in constant competition. It's, that reptilian brain is somebody who views everybody as a threat to them. They don't view the world in terms of unity consciousness, in terms of
Right.
What's mine is yours and what's yours is mine, because a real emotionally intelligent person would understand that there's plenty to go around. And if we would actually just work together, I mean, I'll admit that one of the reasons that I became so interested in all of this is I kind of thought to myself, well, if I've got to live on this planet, you know, amongst a lot of people that know a lot of times no fault of their own, but operate under this paradigm with this sort of, you know, consciousness that is now fueled the way that their body responds to stimulus, the way they process things, the way they compartmentalize the world as in black and white, and this duality consciousness. You know, I think that to me is really the norm, and it's based on a lot of fear being projected into the atmosphere that is very, some of it's very subtle, but let's just look at the news and all of the fear that is, you know, is so rampant that, you know, that vibration of fear is constant. It causes chaos, confusion, and it's from, you know, a place that is designed to keep us down, keep us low. And it's like, I thought to myself, if I'm going to have to deal with all this, I may as well, you know, figure it out like a little bit better so that I can try to at least educate other people on it, because I think it really just stems from that a lack of understanding of how it all works. And people don't want to talk about these topics because, you know, they're heavy or they, you know, are just, yeah. And so then it remains in the darkness. That's why it's called the dark triad, because it's not understood. It's not talked about. And if it is talked about, it's just a bunch of blame shifting, right?
Right, right. And I've participated in the blame shifting too. But let me tell you, when you're on the floor, you know, suffering from mental anguish over one of these people, you are about as narcissistic as you can get in some of your behavior, because you have been emotionally violated by someone. So that's, and that's a state that you live in. I hear that again and again and again. And I said the same thing to am I the narcissist? I mean, every victim of narcissistic abuse that is actually the victim goes through that phase of, am I the narcissist? Am I the one? Well, and I always say, I didn't realize this, and now I get it now, of course, you know, years out from it. The very fact that we have the wherewithal to ask that question means that the answer is no. A narcissist isn't going to ask that question of themselves, or they're going to be proud of it.
They don't have the consciousness.
Exactly. Or they're going to be proud of it because they think that they absolutely believe that they're superior. And every time they con someone, that inflates their already over, you know, grandiose sense of superiority over people. So it's a vicious cycle. And it's hard for us as highly empathic people because they count on our pity. They hate us for pitying them because they believe they're superior, and yet they milk as much pity as possible from us so that we will feel sorry for their poor wounded souls, and that's why they're the way they are. And it's a cyclical game that keeps you sucked into this toxic behavior of theirs that brings you down, brings you into your primordial brain just to survive a relationship with a reptile.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's important to note that a lot of the traits and characteristics of somebody with PTSD or complex PTSD that is the natural response or consequence to exposure to narcissistic abuse, psychological abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, really any abuse, I mean, is a trauma. And so post-traumatic stress is the natural reaction. It becomes a disorder, obviously, when it is not being healed and the symptoms are perpetuating or worsening with maybe panic, fear, terrors, nightmares, constant ruminations, obsessive thoughts, obsessive thinking, which, you know, happens when the PTSD isn't being treated or treated successfully, and the energy is just sort of, you know, remaining in the body and it's not being released in any way, in any sort of positive way. And so I think that it's normal that there are some of those narcissistic tendencies, but the difference is that with proper treatment and acknowledgement of the fact that there was a trauma that that was experienced, that that can be, those symptoms will be alleviated hopefully over time. And the key is that there's an awareness of the fact that these traits exist or whatever. And that's exactly what they don't want us to admit. They don't want us to admit that there was a trauma or that right. any of these things happened. In fact, that's one of their biggest weapons, is to convince somebody through gaslighting or one of the other forms of mental abuse that that experience didn't even happen. I don't know what yes. you're talking about, but you're imagining things.
You're crazy. You know? So, how many times have I heard that?
Right.
And I'm like, but wait a minute. The sky is not black. It's blue. And
right.
I'm being gaslighted into believing that it's black. And I'm like, but no, there's the proof, cognitive dissonance right there. I mean, it's crazy making. It is crazy making for those of
they
us who are sane.
They want you to question your own ability to, you know, experience something
truth.
That, you know, happened and then question your integrity as far as, you know, okay, did that really happen? And then test how firm that you will stand in that. And that's a way for them too, to test boundaries, to see how easy it might be for them to manipulate you so that you start to adopt their, you know, their analysis for what happened rather than your own. So, because if they can do that, now essentially they're sucking away your identity.
Absolutely.
And you're just becoming like a skeleton and a puppet to them. So I think that's a big part of it too. So talking about it in the way that we are and writing about it in a creative way that doesn't have to be us bashing them. I mean, we're talking
right.
about them in an objective way. I think that's definitely a way for us to own the experience and become stronger for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm so glad that you're doing this show, because I know you're going to be talking about it.
Yep. Going to be talking about it. And I really just want to talk about some of the cases that I've had and how this is really playing out in court and just in law in general. It can expand to other types of schemes and fraudulent schemes that we talked about in your show, The Grifter Show.
Yeah.
Tales from the Grift, which was awesome, because there's a ton of people that, you know, are going through this with, and they're going through it with companies that, you know, maybe other people need. Okay. Maybe other people could benefit from experiences that somebody have with, you know, a moving company, or there's a lot of companies out there that exploit vulnerable people that aren't educated, or again, they use fear, you know, they use fear as a way to sort of run game, because they feel like the victim or the person who needs their help won't have the balls to maybe go on, you know, radio or TV or whatever, or even online and speak their truth. So
Absolutely.
They rely on that. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was a great first show. Awesome
Absolutely.
Conversation as always. And thank you for your show and what you do for the world right now. I appreciate you.
Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder Radio with Megan Lyons. Megan enlightens other narcissistic abuse survivors to find true healing and inner peace through the beautiful art and practice of self-love. Megan knows it because she's lived it. The work on this show is powerful and life-changing and provides a compelling purpose for survivors to be the light in the world. Tune in every first and third Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on Transformation Talk Radio. To download this podcast and for more information about Megan Lyons and her work, visit EnterTheLightLLC.com.